Welcome to the Tabletop Treehouse, where we like to take Barbie and G.I. Joe and make them fight.
Folks, it's always good to have you back up here. My name's Dennis.
I'm Chris.
And, we got another door here to step through today.
It's the one with the shield with the writing on it, right?
Yeah, I'm still kind of curious what language that is in, but, yeah, why don't we go through and take a look, right?
I mean, maybe it's in the dark language of Mordor.
Mordor. Eh, can't be that bad. We'll take a look.
Yeah, let's go take a look.
I'm sure it's fine.
Dennis, why is there a conveyor belt with giant stone heads that shoot lasers off of them?
I mean, you know, sometimes you find some inspiration in the map you choose, and then you just got to build around it. I mean, don't blame me. Blame the map maker.
You know, I would never have blamed you and just said it was cool, but now we go through these doors, and they're obviously to the worlds that we create. We need to be a little more careful about the worlds that we create.
I never thought I'd be visiting them personally. I thought I was just developing things for my players to enjoy.
Correct, but apparently when we walk through these doors, they're taking us to the places that we've been. Well, or made.
Right, but I shouldn't hamstring my storytelling.
Yeah, that's fair.
All right.
We'll just survive them. Level 20 D&D is painful.
Level 20 D&D is extreme. I feel like not a ton of GMs, you know, find themselves there. It's definitely, you know, maybe that aspirational goal, and it's tough. There's a lot of crunch, but it's also a hell of a lot of fun. But your players are very powerful, essentially. I had my party running through basically the tail end of their adventure. They're definitely coming up on the culmination. They're looking for these lieutenants of the big bad.
Okay.
Tracking them down. They've already dealt with one. They find the other guy in... They know he's staying in this kind of factory lair that he's built.
Note what I just said.
They you know, some investigation, they learn that he has this recharging period that he goes through. So he's kind of down, you know, for a bit, and maybe they have an opportunity to sneak in and get at him.
Oh.
So they lay low for a bit. They find their way in through a back door, you know, bypass a good amount of the dungeon, to be fair.
Everybody loves a back door.
Right. And then they made their way further in, eventually encountering, you know, various denizens that that Primus, this lieutenant, had set up in place. Through some bad rolls and decisions of their own, Primus basically became alerted to their presence. Unbeknownst to them at the time, he was like, well, I'm going to hop off my recharger pod and prepare for this battle that's coming.
He was the Primus, but he wasn't the big bad. He's just Prime.
Right, yes.
That's hilarious.
You know, the levels of primality, right? Maybe
primality.
I don't know. Is that a word?
What's the big bad guy's name?
He's called the One.
The okay, so right? So yeah. So are they the same person then? The Primus and the One. There can be only one Primus. There can be only Prime Oneus.
To what the players know at this point, the One created Primus.
Oh, interesting.
So perhaps there is a little bit of himself. Yeah. Who knows?
Who knows?
I can't reveal yet, just in case my players watch this. The characters, you know, got into this space where they found the recharging station, but instead of the station itself, they found an elevator shaft. Made their way down, found this big door, got their way through there, heard all these crazy machinery. You know, maybe some conveyor belts.
With giant stone heads that shoot lasers. And they might not have done it in his game, but they did it to me.
There's plenty of things shooting at them in there. But they made their way in.
Lightning bolt, death. Disintegration ray.
Just a few.
Paralyzation ray.
It's a level 20 party. They got plenty of defenses to line up.
Yeah.
Since I had already, you know, I had decided that Primus was aware of them, or well, because of the roles, Primus had become aware of them, so he was preparing himself for this upcoming battle.
Makes
he knew
sense.
They were coming. That being said, I rolled for initiative, and he rolled a 3.
Oh, he got murdered. This guy probably died in 2 rounds.
But he was already, you know, he was already in a space that, like, they wouldn't see when he came in. So I just kind of bided my time. When he made his reveal, I had him fly out to the center. And, you know, I decided he had missed his big moment at this point. You know, he was going to confront this party, you know, if he had gotten that, you know, nat 20 initiative roll, maybe. But I decided at this point, you know, why not take a moment and let him say his piece? So while it might have lasted a little longer than 6 seconds, I gave Primus his monologue moment.
Who actually pays attention to 6 seconds in their initiative order?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you get that granular,
said that on the internet, so somebody did. And you're going to tell me that I'm wrong. It's fine.
Well,
I get it.
You know,
wrong.
If you're playing Raw and it's a more This was a very narrative moment. This is a culmination of a big investigation, a huge battle.
He's explaining it to you. He doesn't have to explain it to me because I'm like, you should just narrate your stuff in the middle of initiative because what are they going to do?
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's my turn. I'm talking. And yeah, I mean, you don't want to be having, you know, doing a grand treaty and, you know, going back and forth, but allowing your enemy, the player's enemies to say their piece if it's, especially if it's conducive to the narrative that's going on, if it's going to reveal some lore or information about what they might be coming up to next, or even maybe revealing something about that enemy that they can use in that battle even. Like, there's plenty of fun things you can do that, while giving you your own moment in the spotlight to be like, yes, I am Primus, and you have found your way to my lair, and now I will kill you. I mean, there was more to it than that, but...
Very Skeletor from Masters of the Universe. I saw the movie. It was okay.
I haven't caught it yet.
It's pretty fun.
But now I know to step in for the voice roles.
I mean, you couldn't have done any worse than Jared Leto. He was fine.
Oh, Jared Leto. It was a very satisfying moment for me as a GM to get to do that. And I think it was, and I think I kept it satisfying for the players because, you know, I did use that to kind of then reveal a little information about the next lieutenant they were going to look for because they have their own little Primus and
Secondus.
No, not Secondus.
Tertius.
Well, shoot. Now you've totally blown my brain and I'm not going to remember the name.
I'm so sorry. I thought you were doing a Modron thing for a hot second there.
The first one that they found was this kind of like gambler, chaos, demon-y sort of guy. Primus is a construct, more martial-based. He kind of leads the armies for the one if they need to be led anywhere. And then there's a magic user, Keto. Yes, I named her Keto. And that's who they're going to face next. Primus and Keto kind of have a bit of rivalry. So Primus was talking some shit about Keto in his monologue. They got to learn a little bit of information for the next battle they might face.
Oh, that's fun. Yeah. That's fun.
And, you know, it was just him, you know, talking big, essentially. He wasn't purposefully revealing it, but it was revelatory nonetheless.
Nice.
And, yeah, I think it's a good way to keep the party, keep the players, you know, interested when it's not their turn, essentially, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's part of what we're here to talk about today.
Yeah, so the question that is being raised by this story is, how do we keep the narrative going during a combat, especially in your turn-based games like Dungeons & Dragons or Pathfinder or Savage Worlds or Daggerheart or Drawsteel?
Yeah, if it's not a narrative-based game, you know, this... If you're playing something like Powered by the Apocalypse-type game, it's going to be a little more... intrinsic how it works.
The narrative is part of the game.
Yeah, exactly. But for like a turn-based, a more granular, crunchy, there's definitely tools you can use, and let's go through them.
Sure, I would love to. A lot of people complain about combat being slow.
Yes, and, you know, particularly higher-level D&D, it can bog down a lot. Everybody's got a lot of skills, a lot of powers, a lot of attacks.
Mm-hmm.
And while it can slow down, if you keep it interesting, if you keep that narrative going throughout the turns, it doesn't feel that way, right?
That's true. Yeah. It does. It can feel like it can bog down. But I'm not somebody that needs the fight to go faster. I just need to feel like, even if it's not my turn, that I'm engaged.
Precisely. Yeah. How can you stay? Oh, hi, Rico. Rico's here
now. We'll get into the idea of how that just occurred. Would be a way to do that, which is like change the situation. we'll talk about that in a hot second.
Right.
There are games that do some of this. So one of the problems with Dungeons and Dragons combat, the 5th edition versions and things like that, especially at the higher levels, is it does take a long time to get around to your turn, and there's not very much for you to do when it's not your turn.
Yeah. I mean, maybe you've got a reaction to use somewhere,
maybe
counter spell or opportunity attack.
Uh-huh.
That's only if the combat's in motion or the spellcasters.
And then a lot of people will check out.
Right.
And that is,
you know, bring out the phone, they're scrolling.
Yeah, it's less than optimal. Right? Yeah. There are games that do a pretty good job of keeping you engaged by giving you things to do that when it's not your turn, which, like, Drawsteel has a lot of mechanics that take care of stuff like that.
Yeah.
Daggerheart is a game, because of how the initiative works, you could go at any time.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't matter. There's not really an initiative order exactly. And the same person can go multiple times in a row if they want to. And you're always kind of like looking to be like, what should I be doing next? Or how can I help? Or do I have enough resources? Or how many fear? Like, you're just tracking stuff as you're playing.
Right.
I don't play enough Pathfinder to talk about it. Savage Worlds, there's always cards that are coming out, and there's just like things happening, so it's very tactile. But the engaging part is the thing that I need. So, I mean, this is all dependent on the player and the person, but for me, engaging is when it's not my turn, am I being entertained?
Yeah.
And when it is my turn, am I being entertaining to others?
It is a little less on the players, but the players should be aware of it as well, right?
I mean, I think it's on the players because I'm the kind of game master that asks people to tell me what it looks like when they're doing stuff.
Absolutely.
Because I don't want to be a 90% narration, 10% narration game master. I really try to get to that 60-40 where I'm talking about 60% of the time to 40% of the time. I even try to get even more than that, 50-50. And I don't mean 50 me. It's like 50 me, 50 the other, all the players.
Yeah, yeah, the entire,
because you
got to
manage, right?
Yeah.
So that leads to a lot of like the game master asking questions, the game master interacting with the players when it's their turn. Like, what does this look like? Cool, you cast that spell. Like, are you sure that's what you're doing? And some of this is knowing the rules so you can keep things moving.
Yeah.
Some of this is integrating that their bits with what's going on and trying to keep everybody on page in the same mind space for what's going on in the combat. That's really important in a game with miniatures and stuff. It's actually a little bit easier because you have the visuals.
Yeah, yeah. If you're playing on a table, if you've got a tabletop map, or if you're doing a virtual, it can make that sensing where things are and knowing positioning a lot easier. But if you're doing Theater of the Mind, that's a very important part of it as well.
Yeah, I mean, I would not recommend doing Theater of the Mind with certain games. Like,
no, the high level D&D, you should at least have some like gummy bears and
something. Yeah. At least have a relative positioning map,
right?
If nothing else. But that game has so many distinct areas and measurements that it more behooves you to have a map with miniatures on it. Now, that doesn't mean you can't play without the bits and bobs.
Yeah.
It works just fine. I know people that do it.
I've done it. It then becomes more of a GM ruling for, am I actually in range?
Yeah, and
unless it's specifically delineated beforehand in your description of the room or whatever, but we're getting into the nitty gritty here.
I mean, that's okay. We can get into some of that nitty gritty.
Right.
If you do want speed, there are ways to do that. Well, one, you need your players to know what's up. Like they need to understand their characters.
Yeah.
So they can make choices and like not get bogged down in looking up how spells work and things like that.
Can I use evasion?
Do I have sneak attack? Can we not ask that question? I'll get to that. Like I will get to that in a second. The person that likes to ask the question, like, do I have sneak attack? They're actually doing an episode on another podcast called the Gnome Cast, where we talk about it might have come out before this episode because we record these and they come out like months later,
right?
Or a month or two later, about the hustle.
Oh yeah,
the hustle, where it's like you're hustling to try to get something out
to
of the game.
To get that advantage, year. Yeah,
yeah. But
I do it a little.
We should, yeah. We that is one of those things that actually slows combat down.
Yeah, that's true.
But it can also be a point of engagement and teaching and understanding play culture for the table. And I think it's worth talking about in this, for that idea of like, if somebody asks me, do I have sneak attack? I'm like, what would give you sneak attack?
Right. Yeah. Like build the narrative or tell me why.
Yeah. Like what in the rules or what narratively gives you sneak attack in the situation? Yeah. If you can't answer that question, then I don't have an answer for you.
Right.
So probably not.
I don't know. I'm self-reflecting a little here. And I think more so what I do is like, does the thing that happened previously or the position I'm in potentially give me advantage?
Well, I mean, see, that's a good question to ask me because you're using the narrative to try to figure
it out. And that,
which that I'm more prone, liable to say yes to.
Yes. That. Yeah. And I think that's more where my brain's at generally. But
But if you've got seven people at your table or six people at your table,
they got to know their...
They got to know, because you will slow down the game doing that stuff.
Yes.
As a player, know what your character can do. Like, man, if you're playing a wizard and you got 27 spells, maybe you don't know everything. That's fine. But have an idea of what you want to do, and maybe it gets...
It might change mid-turn.
It might, and that's okay.
All of a sudden, the guy you were going to target is dead, but...
Fighters are tricky, too, because when you're at that high of a level, you get, like, 5 attacks or 6 attacks or something silly. These are all things that slow the game down. And sometimes it can be even harder because... you know that you can move between your attacks,
right?
In D&D 5e, like you can just take those steps around bad guys as you're fighting, to get positional advantages and whatnot to get ready to move to the next thing.
Yeah, or if you're playing with flanking and stuff, that becomes a big thing.
If you're using that house rule for that,
yeah.
So you might not want to roll all your attacks at the same time. And I understand that. So just know how to do math fast. At least math for your character.
Like have your bonuses collated, you know, do that prep work, so to speak.
And that can even be tricky if you're somebody that has like Power Shot.
Yeah.
Because then at least Power Shot, I think it's all or nothing, if I remember correctly. It's not like it used to be with Pathfinder where you could get Power Strike where it'd be +1 to +5. You choose how much you want to put into it.
Well, yeah, no, I think with D&D, it might have changed for 2024. I don't know if the feat changed. But 2014 was -5 to attack, +10 to damage.
Right. Simple, right? At least simple enough. And +10 is easy.
They might have changed it to proficiency bonus. It's fine for 2024.
It's fine. That's fine. Yeah. It's fine. But there's all these like little things that you can shift around.
Right.
Which means you should be proficient at playing those little things. That's just if you want to play the game in a rapid manner.
Yeah.
Like if your goal is speed. If the table's goal is speed, then these are the things that you need to work on. Mastery of the characters. And the game master, too, because game masters have larger stat blocks at those levels. And probably more minions.
Right. And you know, I do my best to keep apprised of, you know, what my players have, you know, in their holster, so to speak.
Sure.
As everybody levels up, I have more, like all the monsters and everything have more. They have more stuff on their pages. So, yeah, there's often times where, you know, I don't quite know how that power works. Let me look it up. Mm-hmm. And if the player was confident in their knowledge, it would speed that up greatly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You have a note in here where you don't want high-level D&D to be tedious. Now,
right.
Most of my experience comes from those level 12, 13 games. Mm-hmm. So I've run several games, probably like, I think 9 games have gotten into those levels.
Yeah.
So, like, I've run a bunch of games in those levels, but never really higher than that because I always stop there because I don't want to play beyond that because I think it's aggravating.
It can, well, so the...
It's not fun for me.
What I found frustrating was instead of just, you know, running cool scenarios or finding cool hooks for the players to follow, you then also, because D&D is a combat game.
It is.
You then also have to kind of build, and not all of them obviously, but like for battles that might quote unquote matter or that you want to have an impact, you do kind of have to design around your party's skills.
I think you should do that anyway.
And it feels, I don't know, part of it to me feels a little like, and yeah, like you want to do things that are going to let them shine. Random example, say one of your players is a silver dragonborn, they have resistance to cold. Throw a few cold monsters at them, let them shine, that kind of thing. But when you have Rico, come on up.
Rico's here, man. He's into it. He's into this conversation.
Yeah, you like this one. Yeah, good boy. Hello. So do those things to let your players, you know, kind of showcase and shine. But then on the other side, it felt like I need to have monsters that will be able to resist them as well.
Uh-huh.
And like sometimes that felt a little cheesy, like, oh, shoot, I have to not nerf their abilities, but cancel them out so this monster will last a little longer.
So I don't think it's necessarily nerf them or cancel them out. Now, if these are the big bads of the campaign, they probably know, and not just the big bads, but if they're the ones that are organizing and getting ready to fight against these player characters that are trying to stop them, they probably know who they are.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So that means they've probably put in countermeasures in place to deal with them.
Yes.
So you have narrative positioning to do these things.
That's a good point. Yeah.
It's really fun to point out. It's like, oh man, these golems look like they've been modified with a bunch of fire spells and also cold resistance.
Right.
Because they know who you are and they're specifically targeting you.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, oh no, they know who we are.
Well, and I did do that at one point. They were being tracked down by a rival government back before they were ever in this position they're in now. And yeah, essentially, they did research on the party. Then they developed a team to specifically go after, and they had like 3 guys who could counterspell because all my party could cast spells. Sure. I was like, well, they're going to need that defense.
I hate counterspell and silvery barbs. I think they're like the worst spells ever.
Silvery barbs, I'm not a big fan of. Counterspell, I don't have much of an issue with, but I don't know.
It's just one of those things. It's because it's like you basically, I'm going to cast this 7th level spell and then somebody counterspells it. It has like a +25 arcana and it's just gone. Right?
Yeah.
It just feels bad.
Yeah.
Because it's like a null. Like
it becomes a null state of action. Yeah. Which
of a resource that I only have a limited amount of.
Yeah.
Now, people out there that like counterspell, that's fine. Like, I actually have no problem with what you said. Like, you like counterspell? That's good. I just have an argument against counterspell.
No, absolutely. I think part of what it is D&D is also a resource management game.
Yep.
And that's one of the ways to manage the player's resources.
It is
to get them to use Counterspell or to use Counterspell against them.
It's true.
There's obviously tons of other ways to do it. If you don't like Counterspell, there's plenty of other ways to burn your player's resources.
Is my problem with legendary resistances too.
Yeah. Legendary resistance can be a little, feels bad.
I mean, it's the same thing as Counterspell.
Yeah.
Sorry,
that just don't work.
Yeah, right. I mean, there
although it is cool when the fighter does it. Like when they have Indomitable. Yeah, although that's just a reroll.
Indomitable just lets you reroll your saving throw.
Yeah, that's true.
Those are the things that's like, I Counterspell, then I Counterspell, then I Counterspell, then I Counterspell. Like, you can get like a Counterspell chain.
Oh, yeah. You've got enough casters sitting around with all the reactions left.
And it feels silly.
Yeah.
And then there's memes about it on the internet.
They got to just be house rules, but I've definitely seen house rules of the idea of like two and done. Like,
sure.
You can cancel one Counterspell. You can't cancel,
cancel the Counterspell.
Yeah.
I Counterspell the Counterspell.
Exactly.
I Counterspell the Counterspell the Counterspell.
Right. High
level D&D is tough, man.
Yeah. But it is very fun. You have these. I mean, D&D characters to begin with are these heroic fantasy, larger than life, but when they're level 20, they're
like
near
gods. Yeah, they're demigods.
And it can be really, like, one of the funnest things, and I've only really had an opportunity to do it once or twice with them being level 20 and kind of where they're at,
mm-hmm.
but throwing, like, old mobs that they had trouble with.
Oh, yeah,
them.
And watch them get mowed down.
Oh, no, a black ooze. And then they just like, they just look at
one,
it.
One spell, it's gone.
So that is a satisfying thing to see happen. Yes, it can get slow. Yes, it can get tedious at times. But like you're saying, you can do these things in preparation, player side or GM side, to just help make all that go smoother.
We'll be back after a word from our fantasy ad sponsor, Keeley's Pocket Pantry.
Welcome everybody to Howl's Black Market. Today we have this right here,
Keeley's Pocket Pantry, a wonderful little item we'd love to show all of you at home today, or maybe in your hovel. But yeah, we have this wonderful opportunity here. It's got some amazing properties, if I'm to believe what's been told. Yes?
Yes, yes. It has all kinds of food inside of it. It may look small, but it packs a mighty feast.
What do you call one of these things? It's kind of like a gourd or...
A cornucopia.
Cornucopia, that's right. I always see them at the table around the fall.
I suppose we should start demonstrating what's in here then,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. Anything come to mind?
Well, I know that there's some lemon boss, not lembus, because we are not infringing on copyright, but lemon boss. Let me just see if I can't get some there. Oh,
well, hopefully some delicious lemon flavor at least.
I gotta reach, my shoulder.
Wow, that's Jesus. Very deep.
It's very deep. It's a problem. Rico is on top of me now. But look, lemon boss. And I think there's a whole loaf in there, in fact. You know what? Let me go back there and see if I can't find it. Oh,
yeah, because, maybe a piece for each of us. Don't hurt yourself.
It's deep in there, but I found this whole loaf.
Holy
of lemon boss.
That's quite impressive.
Lemon boss.
Now, that'd keep you going for quite a while on the road.
Quite a while on the road. I mean, you might get diabetes, but,
Well, I mean, no, it's got everything a growing boy, girl, goblin might need.
Gnome.
Elf.
Take your fantasy race. Minotaur.
Yeah. Anything. It'll get you where you need to go, the lemon boss.
I think there might be some cookies in there, too.
Oh, yeah. Keebly does always seem to have cookies.
Does seem to have cookies. You want to go in there and grab a cookie?
Do you think it's... No, it wouldn't be our cookies, right?
Our cookies?
I mean, we've always got the cookies. What? He wouldn't have stolen our cookies.
He might have stolen our cookies. You should check.
All right. How far...
I had to reach pretty far.
What is that? I don't know.
Oh, it sounds gross.
Oh,
the squishes sound bad.
Oh, geez. Wait, hang on. No, that feels, I think that's a chocolate chip. Hey, all right, success.
Hey, look, a cookie. It's not even eaten. How exciting.
And that might be stolen from somebody else.
Yeah, it doesn't look like one of ours.
No, yeah.
All right, what else should I go in there and try to grab?
I do remember Keebly saying something about his mom would always bake him up roast cockatrice.
Well, let's see if I can't find a roast cockatrice. Let me just move that out of the way. Maybe some corn or something. Get off of me, whatever you are. That's not dead.
There's. Oh Lord. Well, look at that.
What the hell?
Oh no.
Keebly.
Oh man.
Keebly, you're not supposed to eat the product. What are you doing, Keebly?
We guarantee that any pocket pantry that you purchase for the home will not be you know, pre-eaten. I think that's just a in-studio problem that we're dealing with right now. But folks, again, this wonderful opportunity can be yours for, you know, a very modicum of a price.
Only 37 gold pieces in 3 monthly installments.
3 easy installments. And, I mean, yeah, the months, those are a little more nebulous, but we'll deal with that. The paperwork will come to you in the mail.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I believe if there's anything else.
No, I mean, there is the, there's some warnings.
Oh, we should let the folks at home know. Yes, the Keebly's Pocket Pantry may attract hungry children.
Yep, yep.
Kender.
Aren't they like children?
Well, half and half. Huh. This way, that way.
And the hungry one. Yes. Beware of the hungry one. He is a problem.
The hungry one will be aware when you open the pantry.
He looks kind of like a demonic cookie monster. It's really bad.
You know, that could be a new friend, perhaps. So, maybe. You know, just please get your orders in now. Lines are open. Don't hesitate. And remember.
If you don't order here, you can always go to Zigbob's Magical Emporium. You can buy them there.
That's right. Zigbob's is our main supplier here.
And the most important thing is if you buy a Keebly Pocket Pantry, you will help keep Keebly weird.
Yeah, yeah. And we all want to keep Keebly weird, folks.
Mm-hmm. Keep Keebly weird. Yeah. So we talked about high-level D&D. Let's move on to, like, other fighting.
Yeah,
in just general in games, right? Not a D&D
not
podcast.
D&D specific.
The misstate in role playing games. I don't like when it's a null result, but I do. So whenever somebody misses in my games, I try to provide some amount of information based on that. Yeah. So at least they got something out of it.
Yeah, either reveal something about the person they're attacking, reveal something about the environment.
Yep.
Don't just say, "Oh, you missed. Next turn."
Yeah.
Say you missed and you notice that he's favoring his left leg a little.
Especially if it dodges out of the matters to their stat block, right?
Right, yeah. If that's an indication of, like, hey, they have low dexterity maybe or something of that sort, right?
That gives you a good indicator that, like, spells that target dexterity will work better.
Yeah. Like finding ways to do that helps keep your players engaged, you know, through combat.
We talked about this earlier. The middle of initiative is a great place to monologue.
You going on to Chris's lap
now? There's nothing I love more than when a bad guy pops out and is monologuing, and then the player character is just like, I attack him.
Yeah.
That's why I'm a fan of, like, just monologuing in the middle of initiative.
Oh, I wait for him to finish the sentence and I shoot an arrow. Come on, just let me. Okay, roll initiative.
I like to ask the player characters, at least when we're starting off, what their fighting style or looks like, or when they cast spells, what it looks like when they cast them.
Yeah.
To give some flavor to what it looks like, especially if the game is about that.
Yeah.
Like, if the game's about fighting, then this will come up a lot, and at least it gets that image in everybody's head of what a fight looks like when they're involved in it.
Yeah, and it lets that individual, you know, kind of make things unique to their game. And as long as it's just your magic missiles look like, you know, horseshoes flying out of your hand.
Sure.
Cool. Why not?
That's neat. Yeah. I like that a lot. I'm going to steal that.
Magic Missile can be Gambit's playing cards. Like,
yeah,
you know, it
doesn't change what it does. Yeah, it just changes what it looks like.
You
also useful if you're your wizard's, like, also a gambler.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's fun. Reinforces that idea.
I think they even made some card spells, but yeah.
I think an important thing is that, I mean, we're pretty much in, like, the basic 101s. I mean, the high level thing is interesting. I actually kind of want to run some high level D&D now just to go and re-experience it. Combat should fit the overall narrative of the arc of the story, or, like, whatever's happening. I always talk about this with random encounters, like, theme your random encounters to fit whatever the adventure is.
Yeah. Like, I mean, obviously if you're in a swamp, you're going to roll on a swamp table kind of thing. But even to that point, like, if they're in a swamp because they're chasing down a basilisk, you know, maybe it's snakes. Maybe it's, you know,
maybe the random encounters just come upon a bunch of stone statues.
That shoot lasers?
Well, they're basilisks.
Oh, yeah.
So they get frozen. They get petrified by the basilisk.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
And then those stone statues start moving around because they're being controlled by creeping vines.
Or maybe there's a griffin eating a dead basilisk.
Yeah, there you go. Right? See, those are all themed to the concept of whatever the adventure is.
Right. Whatever your current arc or, you know, mission or goal.
Your adventure, I remember we talked about it in a previous episode. It's in this factory is in the remnants of a necromancer's lair.
Right, yeah. So it was basically Primus retrofitted it to be his factory. Previously, it was this kind of arcane, you know, yeah, a lot of necromancy, a lot of books, a lot of magical studies, that sort of thing.
So it wouldn't be too far out to have, I mean, they're level 20. I'm trying to think of level 20 undead that would even be a problem. Up-leveled Wraithsor or Bodax or whatever that can like drain levels or stats and ability scores.
Yeah.
Not too far of a stretch for those things to be around.
Yeah, I definitely could have maybe had one pop out when they were messing around with the flasks.
Spirits possessing golems.
Yeah.
As a problem in the space.
I did kind of have this basically they made a flesh golem, so that there was a bit of a touch of that.
Nice.
Yeah.
A little Frankenstein action. Yeah. Those are the kind of things that I'm talking about. The Primus one, I'm sure there was like constructs galore everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you said he was the general, so he's probably leading an army, essentially.
Yeah.
He's probably got some command-type abilities to have like army things happen in the game as like legendary actions.
They did a really good job leading up, basically distracting, not all of it, but a good portion of his army out of the base. Then they snuck in the back, skipping some amount of bag. Like, those bad guys are now behind them and they might show up.
Sure. And that's fun.
But no, they did a really good job like getting to his specific lair. And now they just got to deal with that. We're still kind of mid battle right now.
Let me hit you another one that we put down. Crits, using them to your advantage, high or low, to propel the narrative. Tell me about
it. It's a free exclamation point, you know, for the moment, essentially. Like, whether a 1 or a 20. And I'm not a big fan of like critical failures, like where they actually, you know, are breaking a weapon or things. Like, there's tables you can use out there. Long story short, I'm not a big fan of it because it hinders characters that roll dice more.
But if Dimension 20 and Brandon Lee Mulligan has taught us anything, ones are just as much fun as 20s.
Yes, but I just don't like when, like, maybe I just have horror stories in my own experience, but
I'm with you with what you said.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't mechanically have to do anything, but narratively it can create some fun.
Narratively,
right?
It's great, yeah, and describing something, even if you describe it in a very severe way, as long as it's not actually like, it may be like disadvantage if it's like really insane or if the player made a really dumb choice.
I'm gonna drink this black sludge in the middle of combat. Make a constitution saving throw. Yeah. I rolled a 1.
Guess what?
You turn into a slime. You can move around now for a while.
Yeah. Gloop.
What do I do?
Gloop.
Well, you're a slime. You tell me.
Gloop.
It'll wear off in how long? Well, I rolled a D4. I'll tell you when it wears off.
You'll get there.
How many rounds it'll wear off in.
Right. You got to meet your players' choices and desires, right?
Yeah.
Even if they're crazy sometimes.
I mean, there was a chance that the black goop was going to make me super strong for a round or two.
Yeah.
But it just didn't work that way.
You never know. Got to try all the goop. But yeah, I think crits can really help you build that narrative during the combat, focusing on that specific point. If the character is a follower of a god or anything of that sort, you can, you know, maybe say the god, you know, shines down on you at this moment, or your god looks away, you know, that sort of thing. You can tie in that kind of flavor if they're a religious type character for magic. Yeah, the arcane weave is just out of your grasp, or, you know, for the first time ever, you feel the entire course of the universe coursing through your fist, you know.
That's really fun, right? You can get that little extra bit of narration.
It's a marker where it's like, oh, I have, and not you have to, but it really highlights, like, here is an opportunity to really showcase some flavor.
Yeah.
If you're not doing it every other turn as well.
Yeah, right. I mean, that we should bring that up real quick. So I mentioned the thing where I'm like, I like to do narration, and I like to let players narrate stuff that they're doing.
Yes.
I don't think it's worth it to do it for every die roll. I think every 3 die rolls is generally probably a good metric.
Yeah, and you'll
feel it out, but that if you're looking for a number out there, folks, I think 3, like, you don't have to count it every time to be exactly 3. Sometimes it can be 2, sometimes it can be 4. Change it up. Don't be predictable.
Well, a lot of times what I'll end up doing is, so my home table can get very big at times. Like, sometimes I'm playing with 6 players.
Yeah.
When some people can't make it, or if we're doing like a little offshoot and I have a smaller table, usually I'll just do a little recap after a round.
Yeah, that helps.
If there's not, you know, if there's not a ton of monsters in the initiative order kind of thing, it's just like, All right, so first up, you know, Jackson runs over and he slashes his sword, and then, Bartholomew launches a firebolt at the goblin. Then the goblins rush forward, and you know, you just go kind of narrate the scene after everyone's done their roles.
Yeah, it's a great trick to use. I do it all the time. Sometimes it's after everybody goes, sometimes I'll wait for two to three people to do it, then I'll recap.
Yeah, if it's a bigger group, you kind of keep that momentum going mid round. Yeah.
Sometimes if it's just a bunch of misses, I'll just wait until something interesting happens.
Right.
Or I'll wait for the miss that feels like it has some narrative impact, and then try to drop some that, or ask them what it looks like as they how they fail in that moment, because failure can teach us as much about a character as success.
Absolutely.
It just doesn't have to be every time.
Yeah.
Whatever feels right for the table is usually the best thing. Whatever keeps them engaged. Like I said, speed is not as important as engagement, in my opinion.
No, and that is something, you know, to kind of make note of is as you play, you know, obviously if it's your first time sitting down with a group, you're going in a little bit blind, perhaps. If you're longtime friends, it's different, but over time you're going to learn what engages your players. You're going to see what they, you know, are drawn to, what sort of thing. Like, oh, one of them's a treasure hound. One of them, you know, wants to map out the entire country. So, and you find those hooks to keep your players engaged and, yep, you know, drop little hints here and there where you can.
We're going to get into some of the ones that I think are the most important now. Like these are my secret sauce ones anyway, the ones that I use. It's about the environment. The environment needs to be important and interesting to whatever is happening in the combat. Now, yeah, it can be as simple as we're in this 20 by 20 foot room, and there's a 10 foot by 10 foot hole in the middle. With, yeah, the seven goblins that you're fighting.
Right.
Or seven mud monsters that you're fighting, if we want to get away from goblins. Goblins are people too.
That just becomes a whole grappling.
Just putting the hole in the middle, especially if the monsters can push you or slide you around.
Yep.
The whole fight is different because of that.
Oh, was it?
Drawsteel does,
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
really Drawsteel, well.
Yeah.
Getting pushed into a pit.
I remember pushing people around. That was, yeah, a fun mechanic.
The whole game is different because of just that little change.
Yeah.
So thinking about environments and how they can change. We'll talk about change in a second. But think about how your environment can impact your combat matters a lot. Like when you talk about CRs or balance or things like that, a lot of times they don't take into account environments. Daggerheart does. Good on Daggerheart. Like that's kind of a fun part of that game.
Yeah.
But Drawsteel absolutely does.
Right.
I'm pretty sure Pathfinder 2 does from the stories that I've heard from people telling me.
I haven't played much, yeah.
I haven't played much either, but your environment matters. Just that one simple change that I mentioned in that one simple combat changes everything about that fight.
To this point, I play a lot of video games, so I'm going to bring them up occasionally.
Sure.
There's a D&D game called Solasta.
Solasta and Solasta 2.
Yes.
I haven't played Solasta 2 yet. Solasta's great. Solasta's also brutal.
Yes, but what? So, like, I've been playing D&D since I was, like, I don't know, 12 or 10 or something, so 30 years. It took this game that I played, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago when it came out, maybe a little longer now. The way that they implemented the environment and elevation,
right,
and the ways you could interact with it and the things I could do, it like it changed how I ran battles.
It matters. It
was a very like bang, eye opening, you know, brain explode kind of like, I've been wrong this whole time. Not wrong, but you understand.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
In conjunction with this concept of like make pieces of your environment matter to the fight.
Yeah.
It's changed the environment or changed the parameters of the combat after a period of time so that you don't get bored.
Yeah. Don't keep everything static.
Yeah. I have examples. It's usually in the third round is when I usually do this kind of stuff is in D&D anyway. In other games, it depends on the game and how the flow is going.
Yeah, I mean, D&D, if you're still in combat third round, it's either a very tough battle or everyone's rolling terribly.
Yeah, and that means things should change.
Yeah.
Because it'll make things more exciting. It'll refresh the fight in a lot of ways.
Right.
And what I mean by that is, for instance, if I have a dragon, I often won't let the dragon breathe until round three because that'll change the fight.
Interesting.
I've run probably 5 or 6 dragon fights in my life, like big dragon fights. And like it was the end boss battle of a thing. They were fighting this dragon in this mountain that they've been dealing with for like the entire campaign. His city of people, his city of dragon folk and dragon kind and kobold ninjas and people like that. Round three, he breathed and hit. They had like NPCs there with him and everything, like their allies and whatnot. Hit 10 of the 11 characters that were there, and almost everybody was unconscious at that point, dying. and things change, right? Like that changed the complexity of the fight. And then another player character had a thing that they could do that saved everybody, but it cost them a ton.
There you go.
But like it changed the fight. But I do that in all kinds of things. Like you have the people come in from off screen. You have the building wall explode for some reason. Like somebody does something where like you've already set it up that like, there's powder kegs that are like over there and they caught on fire and nobody did anything about it. So it blows up, right? That's an environmental thing that is occurring in the fight. That's what I'm talking about. Stuff like that.
Yeah. Keep things active. If everything remains the same throughout the entire combat, it's not guaranteed it's going to feel bland, but you're going to serve yourself, the combat, and your players better by doing by introducing these sort of things.
Yeah, and you don't have to always do it in the third round. That's just my starting point. I'll either not do it, or I'll move it to the fourth, or I'll put it in the second.
Yeah, just as needed kind of thing.
Yeah, otherwise you become predictable, and the last thing you want to be is predictable.
You don't want to fall into the Zelda trap of, oh, if I hit the boss three times and then run away, it gives me the opening.
I mean, that's a skill issue.
Right.
That's a skill thing, because you still
get good.
You want to be better at this stuff? Work on describing things.
Yeah, you can do your own kind of homework, essentially.
This is a deliberate practice moment.
Yeah.
You can deliberately practice this skill at getting better at describing things.
Yeah. Read descriptive fiction.
Yep, really helps with that.
Even just fantasy books. Like, I've read a lot of lit RPG lately, and I get plenty of ideas from there.
Right? There's all sorts of wild stuff happening in those things.
Yeah. Dungeon Crawler Carl, if you're not familiar.
I mean, the later books, you need to understand that is probably pretty good stuff for like higher level D&D, because those people are, they're superhuman, right? And D&D characters at those higher levels are superhuman.
So absolutely.
They're giving you some pretty good indications of what maybe these characters could look like.
Yeah.
Watch high-end GMs do it. And you don't have to copy them exactly, but it's not a bad place to start. I mean, people get good by mimicking other people.
Yes.
Especially people that are good at what they do.
Yeah, watch some actual plays, you know, Dimension 20, Critical Role, take your favorite, you know, Legend of Avantress, I think.
Yeah, Legend of Avantress has their own actual play on Not Another D&D podcast. Yeah, you can go back and listen to if you're into comedy stuff, listen to the McElroys.
Yeah.
Adventure Zone.
Right.
There's Rigmarole's pretty good. That's a newer one that a lot of people don't know about, that's really well produced and they have decent stuff. The new D&D Dungeon Master's actual play.
Oh yeah, I haven't actually caught that yet.
It's pretty good. I mean, they have an excellent game master. I forget what her name is offhand, but she's fantastic.
Is it Abria doing it or
not Abria? No. I mean, Worlds Beyond Number. That's Abria. Abria's run. I mean, she just gave birth to a kid, or so she's not game mastering Solari right now. But Lou's about to run another game of something over there. Cool. Lou Wilson. So, but Brennan did the whole. The witch, the beast, and the oracle, or whatever, the wizard, the sorceress. I forget what it's called, but that one was pretty good. I mean, these are all different styles.
Yes,
which is what I'm really getting at is like these are different styles of game being run by game masters who also have different styles, and sometimes it's even the same game masters running different styles of game. Like Dimension 20 is a comedy game with a bunch of improvisers. Brennan's running Critical Role, and it's very different.
Yeah, yeah.
And still good.
Something just occurred to me, kind of maybe picking back off the same idea. Old radio plays, or current radio plays, even.
Yep. Like, I mean, because they're kind of coming back drama. Into the... There's audio drama's been around again for a while now.
Yeah, it's coming back into the milieu.
Go find your Lauren Shippen's The Bright Sessions. There was Ars Paradoxica is a really good one if you like time travel stuff. There's Midnight Burger, which is really good. The White Vault, if you like horror. I could go on and on. I love this stuff.
I'm doing this off the cuff. I hit a nerve. Well done. I was like, well, yeah, I've listened to one or two. You're like, hey, I gotcha.
I mean, unsurprisingly, it's a thing that I really like.
There you go.
Since I like editing audio.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm generally impressed by it. Watch action sequences in action movies if you want to be better at describing combat.
Yeah.
It's the same as listening or reading books about action sequences, but if you watch them, but after you're done watching them, think about how you would describe that action. Like, what is the verbal description of the action you just watched? That is actually a way to practice describing fight sequences.
I think a big thing that happens nowadays more in other games, I feel like, but I've kind of implemented a little bit into D&D, into my home game in D&D, is treat hit points or whatever that metric is in that specific game if it's not already doing it, not as actual hits your character is taking per se, but more so how well your character can survive and be functional in a fight.
Yeah. If you want to just change the word, just call it hit protection.
Yes. Yeah.
D&D is a heroic game. A lot of these games are heroic games, which means like you're just as functional at full hit points as you are at one hit point.
Yeah. I mean, there's that very, it's a truism in D&D that like the only hit point that matters is the last one.
Yeah, absolutely.
So rather than be like every time your character is taking, or, you know, as a GM, you're attacking your player and they take a sword hit, you don't need to describe as like blood gushes out of their side, or, you know, it's still advantageous to say they're getting hit here and there, but you can describe a hit as just them being exhausted from dodging out of the way of these attacks.
Or blocking sword strikes.
Yes, exactly.
Or if you're wearing heavy armor, like you're just taking the hits on your armor. It's not going through your armor, but you're getting rattled inside of that armor.
Yeah. You're getting a little shell shock.
Yeah.
I think that's a unique way to kind of bring some more narrative into combat if you divest the hit points from that actual I'm taking hits.
And the last one, which I love doing all the time, is just opening it up to the players to describe things.
Yeah.
And not just the how do you want to do this from Mercer and Critical Role, which not a bad one.
No, it's great.
I like it.
Let everyone describe their kills. Yeah.
Yeah. But you can open it up to other moments too. Like, how did you get out of the way of that? How did you take that hit?
Yeah.
How did you bash that guy in the skull in this case? Or what is things like that. Like, you can open up the other descriptive parts to the players. It'll, one, keep them engaged, and two, give you a break when you need to take a breath.
Yeah. Depending on your table and, you know, the kind of trust you have there, you can even kind of open that up even broader to be like, hey, describe this troll that comes in. You tell me what he looks like, kind of thing, you know?
And be like, I'm trusting you here. Yeah. So tell me the awfulness and make it terrible.
Yeah. Given that opportunity, a lot of players are going to be like, oh, cool. I get to be mean to the party. Not mean, but you know what I'm saying? Like, I get to pick the bad guy. Cool.
Choose the form of your destroyer.
Yeah. Marshmallow Man. Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
It was bad.
He was on.
It was terrifying.
I would not want to be the keymaster.
I mean, Kaiju right there. Kaiju, yeah. Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. Cool. So that is our discussion on our tips and tricks about how to make combat more enjoyable.
More engaging.
Yeah, more engaging.
Keeping everyone, you know, clued in. Like, for me as a GM, not that there's nothing worse, but one of the things I hate to see looking across the table is a player on their phone. I mean, if they're using it to look at their character sheet, that's one thing. But when they're clearly like zoned out and scrolling through Twitter or Facebook or something, and it becomes disheartening. And so, yeah, finding ways to keep everybody at the table clued in, ready to jump on their turn kind of thing, following the narrative of the combat, that's ideally following the narrative of your entire arc.
Yeah.
You know, you can mirror these sort of things, again, kind of micro to macro level.
If I'm going to spend 2 hours fighting something, I hope it's worth my time.
Yeah, right.
all around.
Yeah.
Heck, if I'm going to spend an hour fighting something, I hope it's worth my time all around.
Well, yeah, and if I've prepped that encounter, I hope everybody's there for it.
That's a whole nother thing. Like, don't be afraid to adjust your stuff. Like,
yeah.
Please do. Don't just wipe everybody out. It's okay to change it. Like, you don't have to run what you wrote down. You can just fix it.
Well, yeah, to that point, we got to sit down and play some more against Primus recently, but basically less players could show up. So I kind of like, I had to hand wave a little bit because we could only run with three players that time. And I was like, well, I don't want to say no. And this is enough to run. And I could just be like, well, something happens in the factory and a bunch of these machines start short circuiting. So still a difficult battle for the three of them. And then, you know, if next time we play to actually finish it off, they got close. But if everybody shows up next time, well, hey, a bunch of them are going to wake back up.
You know what I would do? I mean, you know what I would do, which is I just NPC the other PCs.
Yeah.
Because I'm that person.
I did a little bit for that, at least for one of them, because they were the one that was actively engaged with Primus at the end of the last battle.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, well, we can't just say she fell out of the sky.
I know, right?
So, yeah, I kind of, you know, rode that one around.
There's
for
a whole
bit.
Thing, the battle that takes longer than the session.
Oh, well, yeah, level 20, you know, a big bad type character. Yeah. He's not the big bad, but he's a, You know, he's a lieutenant.
Yeah, man, my level 12 party, like, it took 4 hours to fight a dragon.
Yeah.
I mean, and it was like 9 rounds, 10 rounds of combat. But like I said, like, you heard all the things that I said. Things changed.
Yes.
So it felt like 4 different fights inside of the one fight.
Exactly.
Right? It had stages to it, which is what you want, really, because it tells a story. You want your fights to tell stories. All right. Well, thank you all so much for being here. If you enjoyed this conversation, would like to talk to us more about how you got something out of this conversation, or how we're wrong, and you'd like to tell us what we should be doing instead, you can come to our Discord.
Yeah. Yeah. Please drop us a line. Let us know what you think.
There's a, it's on the website. You can get a link there. It's in this link in the YouTube. Just copy it and paste it. The show notes of the, on the website, probably in the show notes for the podcatcher that you got the podcast on, if you're listening to it on a podcast. Also feel free to join our Patreon. You can get some extra stuff. We have our PDF of magic items. This month's is Keebly's Pocket Pantry.
Yes, yes, yes. The delicious amenity that every adventurer wants with them on the road.
A D20 of random food type items, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of built it out so that it essentially casts create food, but you roll a D20 to see which food you get, and some of them have some fun effects.
If you would like to get yourself a Keebly's Pocket Pantry, like, card sticker thing, you could just go to our Redbubble store, so, and then you could buy the sticker, put it on a card, and then just hand it to your players, be like, here's your Keebly's Pocket Pantry, and it can just feed people for days and days and days and days.
Yeah, I mean, it's refreshing.
You can buy other stuff from the Redbubble store. We get stuff up there.
Yeah, you get these shirts.
Yeah, these shirts right here. There's more types of shirts than this. There's the color version, there's the black and white version, there's all kinds. All right, well, that's everything for this week. We will catch you soon. So you all have a wonderful rest of your week, and go play some fun games.
Thanks for coming up to the treehouse, folks, and have a safe trip down.
Not down the ladder?
Back down the ladder.